Welcome to Subversion with 1517. Subversion is a podcast dedicated to exploring big ideas, pushing against accepted opinion, and, just maybe, inciting more creative subversion in society. This is a short bonus episode with 1517 Fund co-founder and general partner Michael Gibson. Graduation time is upon us, and thousands of graduates are leaving the safe cocoon of academia and the school to go into the real world. Michael and I discuss some of the social realities not taught in school, like finding structure for yourself and combating loneliness outside of school. Whether you're a recent graduate, or you're looking to drop out of school, or you have already dropped out of school, or you never went to school in the first place, this is not an episode that you want to miss. Subversion is brought to you by 1517 Fund. 1517 Fund supports teams led by young founders with grant, pre-seed, and seed funding, as well as mentorship and a community of hundreds of peers and collaborators. If you're a young hacker, maker, or scientist looking to build your future, schedule a call with us at 1517fund.com/take-action. That's 1517fund.com/take-action. Because a real education is liberation. Now onto this week's show.
One of the things I see recent grads struggle with all the time is they don't know how to build their own, for lack of a better word, like incentive ladders in the real world. So that's why they'll often, especially people who are really good students, I think one of the reasons that they're attracted to jobs that are very similar to school, i.e. Google or Goldman Sachs, is because the learning curve for like all the informal institutions related to it, how to get ahead in those institutions, how to interact with people, just is so it's much less steep.
Yeah, there's a term in design. I think it might be skeuomorphism. And what it refers to is when you're designing a new interface or product, you and you're using a metaphor to do it. You want the features to resemble something that you're originating the idea from. So a classic example is Microsoft desktop, where we all have desks and they have objects on them, and now we're presented with a metaphor in design that this that the UI is a desktop, and so we expect things to move in certain ways, maybe not exactly like an object on a desk moving across it, but if we pick up a file and move it to the trash, it bears some resemblance to that by design. And so I think what you're describing is true of the way the institutions people are used to working in. So they, as you said, they work for 15 years in a tightly controlled organization with lots of top-down commands and performance responsibilities. And then I think these organizations out in the real world, Google, Facebook, large corporations, they bear a design resemblance to it, and therefore people find it easier to navigate or get used to, or at least feel more comfortable taking that job because of that. I hadn't really thought of it as a design issue before. And I think there's a lot to that. And it even comes down to that there's an application process that recruiting is done in the fall through the winter, and then you know where you're going to be in the summer and the fall. And there's a clear ladder that you get to climb over time. And where this really gets pernicious is this idea of the path. I had heard in conversation some guy talking about the path, and he was a Princeton grad. And I said, what do you mean the path, let alone a path? And he said, oh, you know, the path is you go to an Ivy League school and you get a job at an investment bank as an analyst or management consulting. And then maybe after a couple of years, you go to law school or business school, and then who knows what you do after that. But the point was that it's the path, because if you fall off it at any point, if you decide to take a year off and travel, or maybe you do some unusual work, you can't get back on it. So it's like this cycle of these series of really hard tests that you have to pass. And because they bear a resemblance to each other, people, there's something to that where people just are gravitating to it.
So my thought on this is, obviously there are a lot of issues with institutions that are set up this way, because there's a finite number of spots in organizations and institutions that are set up this way, right? Mm-hmm. You can say, you know, that's not how the real world really looks, because for the vast majority of people in the vast majority of organizations, that's not how the real world really looks.
Yeah.
Now, where does the burden of proof fall, though? Does the burden of proof fall on education institutions, whether those are schools or alternative educational institutions, to help people acquire the psychological and philosophical tools to navigate much more amorphous organizations? Or is it on the rest of the world to adopt their structure of the institutions? Because, you know, the analogy I'm thinking about here is actually from architecture, right? You give the desktop analogy, I'm thinking about falling water, right?
I'm thinking
organic architecture. Something is pleasing in organic architecture when it looks like it just flows out of the hillside.
Right.
Christopher Alexander writes a little bit about this on the importance of porticos in houses, right? On the importance of window dressings, things like that, to ease the eyes as they're transitioning from one place to another. So it almost makes me feel like those of us who are advocating for institutions to be less like school, that we are the brutalists, right?
Right.
Trying to start from a start from zero philosophy. And I bristle at that idea. So is that an incorrect analogy, or why should we assume that the schools are off and that we are in the right?
Well, there are some things that school is good at, and I think one of them is competition. So if you set, in the same way you create a 100-meter dash, and then that channels a whole lifetime of effort in trying to get good at that to beat other people. I think in a similar way, school does the same thing, because it has these objectives that they can set, and then people will compete against each other to achieve them. And I don't want to totally poo-poo the benefit of that. I think competition can drive excellence along a number of dimensions. But where I think school doesn't do a good job is in helping us become individuals. And what I mean by that is getting out of the straitjacket of expectations and custom and anything that that is forcing us to conform.
Why is conformity a bad thing?
Well, and so in the trade-off in society and in an organization and in your own life, there's always a trade-off between exploiting your current level of knowledge to gain some sort of benefit versus exploring for new solutions to problems. And how you make that trade-off is up to you. But there's no reason to believe that we're at a local optimum in, the way the economy works, the way we live our lives. And so as a society, I think we do better by encouraging exploration more. And to explore, I think by the challenge it takes to do new things, to not fall into tradition.
By definition, to explore, to go where others haven't and aren't.
Yeah, as you have to not be as susceptible to the shame of being different. So I think schools are very bad at creating individuals. I think they're very good at creating groups that share patterns of behavior and customs and dress. But I think if we want an innovative society, if we want to see progress along all sorts of, in all different fields, science, technology, just happiness even, I think we do need to explore the wide variety out there. We need experiments in living. We need different points of view, and schools just by their nature aren't good at creating that. And I think it comes down to things like the actual architecture of the institution all the way to the subjects being taught.
So what can somebody who is leaving that institution now and who's listening to this and this resonates with them. They want to go explore, but they don't even know where to start because they're that deep in the institution.
Right.
What should they do?
Yeah, that's a great question. The first thing that comes to mind is, and I don't know how true this is, but it was dramatized in the movie Shawshank Redemption. Always bad to draw life lessons from.
I was going
to
say, I think I've heard six different people in the last month draw life lessons from the Shawshank Redemption. Yeah.
So, but nevertheless, let me move forward and do it. Well, there's some sense that people who leave prison because they're so used to being in such a tightly controlled environment for so long, what's this transition period out of that, and how do you rehabilitate people to the real world? I think there's some kind of similar challenge with people who graduate, I think, or who leave school. We saw this in the Thiel Fellowship, where the fellows in the program who had some history with homeschooling or unschooling, even they just seem more resilient and energetic and effective just being out in the world compared to some people who had clearly hit high levels of achievement in an academic setting. So people who had scored fives on every AP exam they ever took, high GPA, high SAT scores, Intel Science Award. And then suddenly without that institutional architecture, they were at a loss, and it came down to like being helpless and fine. It would be like a silly life thing, like deciding to live in an inaccessible part of the city and growing lonely and not knowing how to make friends. So yeah, it can be really hard, and it's so different from the context that you're coming from. So what can people do? I think the first thing you need to do is talk to people and find friends and community. And fortunately, there are tools for that. And at a minimum, if anyone's listening to this and they find themselves in that situation, it's write to us and talk to us, just because we're trying to build a community in what we do, in part because we know that this is such a big problem. What you can do on your own, assuming you're listening to this, but you don't have any interest in reaching out to us, I think. Man, this is like a fundamental problem, not just for people like this, but it's part of Western individualism, the atomization of the individual. I think any organization between the individual and the state seems to be withering. But I think the thing to do is to just follow your interests and be diligent about going to conferences, finding meetups. The best way to make friends, I find, is always around some mutually shared interest, and then friendship ensues from something like of that nature, rather than specifically looking to try to meet people. Obviously dating sites and so on can open up your social, the amount of people you meet. But beyond that, yeah, it is pretty hard. So I think you do have to rely on events and other things of that nature. I don't know, what are your thoughts?
One of the things I have noticed is really, really good for people is engaging in some sort of personal development, which sounds kind of cheesy. Right. But I think that one of the things that school is good at doing, especially for people who are very thoroughly schooled, as in they were very good students, is it gives you a sense of progress towards something. Mm. Now, that might not be a meaningful something, right? One of the core concepts I come back to when I'm talking with people who are going through what I call de-schooling, which is pretty much what we're talking about right now, is that fulfillment or happiness, whatever the word is you want to choose, is not the achievement of goals. It's progress towards the achievement of meaningful goals. And this is a concept that's made by a lot of like psychotherapists.
Yeah, that's really well said.
Nathaniel Brandon has made this point. I think Jordan Peterson makes it. A lot of people in like the Jungian vein kind of make it.
I think that there's this woman at Harvard who's written a book called The Progress Principle, and she's a happiness researcher, and so I think there is a lot of research to back this idea that making progress towards a goal, independently necessarily of what the goal is, can actually make a big difference in people's lives.
Yeah, it helps give people a sense of competence and efficacy, which I think is, Nathaniel Brandon divides self-esteem into two concepts, self-respect and self-efficacy, right? And self-efficacy is your ability to conceive yourself as being able to achieve things, right? It's essentially your competence. And then, you know, self-respect is actually like how you view yourself. How do you respect yourself, right?
Yeah.
And I think that progress towards goals in general is really, really helpful for building self-efficacy. And I do think that there is an important distinction on meaningful goals. Now, if you can't find what a meaningful goal is, then I guess progress towards any goal helps. But
yeah,
the illustration I like to use is, I remember in my bioethics class way back in college, we were talking about welfareism, different theories of welfareism. Mm-hmm. And the instructor made a rather prescient argument against objectivism, not like Ayn Rand objectivism, but that there's this objective theory, that there's this objective set of goods out there that people ought to pursue, right?
Right.
And he essentially said, you know, what if that objective set of goods is watching grass grow? It's like, yeah, so you can make progress towards the achievement of watching grass grow, but that's not going to bring you welfare. you have to choose something that's somehow important to you.
Yeah. Right?
For me, you know, I've moved around a lot. I worked remotely in my first, you know, real professional job, which that's an incredibly atomizing experience. Mm-hmm. I actually discourage people from doing that for their first job.
Yeah.
But for me, one of the things that was really helpful was engaging in some sort of fitness community, right?
Yeah.
At one point, this was Krav Maga. For me now, it's something related more to strength training. That's really important for people. If that's not your thing, you know, maybe take art classes, right? Mm-hmm. Choose some skill or set bucket of skills that is separate from your own professional development, because you don't want your professional identity and your personal identity to be the same exact thing. There's a lot of issues with that we can talk about at a different point. But
yeah, I think that's some really great advice.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I really like fitness. Some people like art, others like writing, music, whatever it is. Find that, pursue that, and you'll naturally develop a community too on top of that.
Yeah, I wonder if conscientious people have a better toolkit by nature to handle this situation than maybe more less conscientious people. I tend to struggle with these things, so I'm not a person who makes to-do lists or takes great joy in keeping a tight Google Calendar up to date, and sometimes, you know, that has come back to bite me. And so I wonder if you enter the real world and this is just something you're naturally good at having. If you do put together to-do lists, you tend to have a better organized day. You tend to have a better direction in your life. And so maybe that can help you bootstrap on a tactical level into a greater sense of movement. One thing I did notice in the TFL.
I want to say real quick on the conscientiousness point, is if you're not a particularly conscientious person, this is why I think that positive constraints are very important on your day.
Yeah.
So just develop a habit of doing a certain set of tasks that will limit what you can do during the rest of your day, right? Mm-hmm. And I really do mean like developing a habit. Get into something where if you don't do it, it really throws your day off, which for a highly conscientious person, it's easier to develop that habit, yes.
Yep. But
a less conscientious person, it's not necessarily difficult. Like for you, it might be one of your positive constraints is that you go to Starbucks early in the morning, right? And you read while you're at Starbucks.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
That's one of the positive constraints you can start building into your day. This is, again, one of these reasons why I think, especially if you're not a particularly conscientious person, do not work remotely for your first job.
Yeah.
Like physically going to the office is a positive constraint. Your commute is a positive constraint.
Funny mind change that occurs. I noticed when I was working from home a number of years ago, I'd experience a little bit of the mind shift if I went out and got coffee and then came back rather than just moving from the bedroom to the kitchen table where I might've set up my computer.
I mean, one of my things is when I have to do actual creative deep work, I work from home at this point now.
Yeah.
I will drive to the other side of town in order to work. If I'm doing a call, if I'm doing a meeting, if I'm doing some shallow work, I can do that at home. I also have an open floor plan in my house, so it makes it difficult to divide where I work and where I live.
Mm.
But physically separating where you work from where you live is another one of those ways that I think you can you condition yourself for focusing on getting tasks done, which is, again, it's actually a separate topic from developing the sense of organization outside school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I noticed with the, and going back to my experience with the Thiel Fellowship, that because all of their peers or most of their peers were away in school, it actually made it much harder for them to find people their own age that they could just hang out with. And I know that can be difficult. And then also certain laws in the country, I think, can make things troublesome. So you can't get in the bars at night. But I think the way you're thinking about things is really wonderful, because you don't, whatever the different areas of your life are, and maybe there are at least three where it's sort of like your hobbies, the things you love, your personal well-being and health and fitness is like one domain. Another domain might be your professional life. And then the third domain might be something like your love life and maybe your family or whatever. And like, you're going to have to bring some level of organization to all of these in order to, because you got to work at them, especially as you get older. Even if you did make friends in college, it's just too easy back then. You didn't have to do anything to maintain that friendship. And I find as I get older, it's not like a effort like rolling a stone up a hill, but you do have to go out of your way sometimes in order to make sure that you maintain your friendships over time. And that means making sure you organize your schedule so you have a day you can spend with your best friend, or making sure you plan hikes and things of that nature.
Right. One of the concepts that I think is really useful here, I've, for lack of a better word, mentored some young men who, 17, 18 years old, who are taking alternative paths, right? They're not going to college. They're going and they're working at startups, or they're freelancers, which that's a really isolating, really hard job to do, especially when you're young. And for them, even, again, they're young men and they're around me. So one of my recommendations is always that they start going to the gym. Especially if they're like dweeby and, 30 pounds lighter than they should be, start doing that. That's a positive constraint that you put on their day.
Yeah.
So there's just less time for them to dick around during the day when they're working. So they become much more effective at work, because there's just much less of this time where it's like, what do I do? And then there is also this proximity issue that I think stems out of what you're talking about here, where you want to actually schedule time to be around people. One of the young men that I've worked with, for example, started going to the gym, and he's friends with some of the meatheads at the gym. And that would have never happened had he not done that, right? So actually doing things that are separate from your job, especially in the startup culture, which I think one of the things I loathe the most about the startup culture is getting people to tie their identities to the company at which they work.
Yeah.
Right? Because that makes it, you almost feel guilty for going out and doing things with people who aren't your coworkers.
Right. And in some ways I love living in cities where there are many different industries. One of the downsides of San Francisco is that it tends to be overwhelmed by people working in tech. And so a lot of the conversations around town can be very one-dimensional. One of the fun things about being in New York or LA and maybe Pittsburgh or other cities is you meet a wide variety of people. And this goes back to the idea of being an individual or exposing yourself to new ideas is you will expose yourself to real diversity out in a city, than doing different activities than you would at it on a college campus, going to the rec center and then going to the library. It's interesting. I'm starting to think more about how certain personalities, I guess one of the key things is you have to know yourself. So we talked about conscientiousness. Another thing is introversion, extroversion, knowing that if you're an extrovert and suddenly you're out on your own in a new city and you don't know anyone, if you for some reason find yourself growing depressed because you're stuck inside and you're not talking to people, that's, you got to develop some habit of checking in with yourself, and that could be journaling. That's probably the best, most lucid way to notice patterns in your thought and moods. But moving beyond that, you do need something so that you, these mechanisms, your emotions, your moods, they're there for a reason to tell you that something is not right in your environment or in the way you're living your life.
So introspection is a ridiculously underappreciated tool for people who are particularly alone. I think for an introvert, now I'm an extrovert, so this is harder for me to fully sympathize with empathize with, is probably the proper phrasing. But I think that as even as an introvert, you know, find structured activities you can tap into, right?
Yeah.
I would imagine, you know, I've never done an art class. You have. So maybe yep. Tell me here. But I can imagine you can be an introvert at an art class.
Yeah. But you're surrounded by people. So I found it to be quite an enjoyable experience because you get the... I'd never reached a level of skill where I fell into a flow state completely, but I did hit moments where I'm totally absorbed and lost sense of time in trying to draw an image. But then I would zone out. I'd take a step back and then maybe grab a cup of coffee and interact with someone for a little bit and then go back in. So there's a loose sense of camaraderie to it that I really enjoyed. But yet didn't have this sort of intensity maybe of some other group activities out there.